This is the Reaction Podcast. I'm Francesca Peacock, introducing the best of the conversations from the Reaction editors and guests in the last week. Our podcast has been on a break, where we focused on creating new shows on YouTube. Good news, we will also make them available as podcasts. The Weekly Listen is your best of show, and soon all Reaction videos will also be available to listen to as podcasts too. More details to follow. This week, Boris Johnson's slump in support among Tory members was analysed by editor Ian Martin and my Reaction colleague Tim Montgomery. Are the Tories losing faith in their leader?
The question, which is the number which is really grabbing people, Tim, is the plummeting score for Boris Johnson. I think he's down 35.7% in terms of the satisfaction ratings, where they rank how the cabinet are doing. That's quite a fall.
Yeah, it's quite a fall. And you kindly mentioned, Ian, that I was founder of Conservative Home. One of the very first things that I did with Stephen Shakespeare, who helped fund the site in its early days, and many people know him as the founder of the YouGov polling organisation, we established these regular opinion polls. And if anyone's sort of doubting, you know, whether they're accurate, again and again, when this poll has been tested, whether it's a Tory leadership race or the selection of Tory candidate for London mayor, you know, it's been proved to be pretty accurate, not perfect, but pretty accurate. So one thing that used to happen was that Tory HQ and that, when they didn't like the results, used to dismiss it. But actually, it's a really good indicator of what Tory opinion's at. And so this 36% decline in the support for Boris Johnson, I would say, is real. It may be 30%, it may be 50%, but it's certainly of that order. And that's a dramatic decline. And I don't know whether it's the confusion over travel guidance. I don't know whether it was that Sunday morning where, first of all, the Prime Minister and the Chancellor weren't going to self-isolate after Sajid Javid was infected, but then had to, you know, just showing that they might have been out of touch with public opinion. I don't know whether it's the controversy over vaccine passports, whether it's the sort of result of things like Chesham and Amersham beginning to filter through into Conservative activist mind. But overall, I just think there's this sense amongst the Tory grassroots that there really is something wrong in Downing Street. And this, you know, it's a bit like a by-election. It's partly why Stefan and I initially set up this opinion poll. The grassroots were never listened to before. You'd occasionally get a Radio 4 person, you know, go down to the Guildford Conservative Association and talk to three or four people. But we wanted to use these polls to send electric messages when necessary, just to give the grassroots a voice in the party. And I think they are saying to Number 10, and I hope they take heed, your performance isn't good enough. And we will see whether we see any change of course.
And that poll always consistently, when it was fashionable, and I plead guilty on this front, when it was fashionable among commentators at Westminster to say that Boris Johnson was, if not finished, was languishing, you know, various periods before 2016, after the Foreign Secretary spell, and Boris was written off. But actually, he was always, as you know from the events you used to organise at Tory Conference, a huge draw with Conservative activists. You could almost take as for granted the fact that the Tories saw him as an Tory activists saw him as an optimist, not all of them, but saw him as an optimistic figure and a winner. Mm. I wonder to what extent, though, is this part of a process by which the Conservative Party is notoriously ruthless, in which maybe his work is done? Mm. Now, this could be very premature. Maybe he goes on being Prime Minister for another 5 or 6 years with another general election win in the middle of it. Anything is possible. But he has been in the front line, in a big figure in British politics, and very popular among Tories now for a long time, going back more than 10 years, or 15 years or so. And maybe just things change and tastes change, and it's a case of your work is done here.
Yeah. Well, even when, you know, we used to get massive attendances at those rallies at Tory Conference, but a lot of the people came, of course, because he was an entertainer. They weren't necessarily approving him as a possible leader. what changed? And I think, you know, there was always those, do you remember the wisdom amongst a lot of commentators was that MPs would never vote for Boris Johnson as leader. But what changed, of course, was that the Theresa May premiership basically just ground into a nightmarish position of paralysis. The Brexit Party broke through. The Tory parties couldn't seem to get Brexit done. The Tory vote had deserted them almost completely in the European elections. And Boris was always a roll of the dice. But they were willing to take the roll of the dice because things were so dire. And then, of course, he won a majority of 80, defeated Corbyn. Brexit's been done. And so he has the roll of the dice was worth it in terms of those two things alone, if nothing else happened. But now we're getting into the real slog of governing and all those doubts that that Tory MPs have had about Boris's capabilities, I'm afraid are coming true. He hasn't built a team around him of sufficient quality, that he kind of thing that he had at a lower level of London mayor to compensate for his, you know, lack of attention to detail. And I can't see Labour winning the next election simply because of the problems they have in Scotland, not least. But I can see the Tories losing the election now. And I suspect that's partly what's motivating, you know, this drop in approval from Tory members.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. Labour has huge problems itself. I wrote at the weekend in my reaction subscriber newsletter about this question of why is Labour, I mean, we're now effectively in midterm after a pandemic, which has, you know, which has turned the economy and society upside down, and Labour is excited to just be within reach of the Tories, and the Tories lead in poll after poll. So even though the gap has closed, and even that most recent piece of YouGov polling, which showed the Tories falling in southern seats by, you know, substantial chunk, still miles and miles ahead of Labour, and Labour only going up by 4% in that poll. That was the YouGov polling on Saturday. So there's no sense yet of Labour having definitively broken through. You know, you need a run of 6 months or so where Labour is consistently ahead in the polls. It's not happening yet, but I do wonder whether just even the closing of the gap suggests to Tory members and Tory activists that something about his magic has worn off.
That was Ian and Tim discussing the Tory leadership possibilities. Now, what is Piers Morgan's favourite subject? The wicked among you might say it's Piers Morgan. Here, Ian and Tim discuss the attempts of new channel GB News to sign up the broadcaster and journalist to boost its fortunes. If they hire Piers, will it end in tears?
Piers Morgan, big figure in UK broadcasting, now doesn't have a gig in broadcast terms, but of course he writes for the Mail, and he writes a lot for Twitter. But the thinking is that he may be hired as the person to give GB News a big boost.
Yeah, well, this has been a rumour ever since he walked off the GMB show, Good Morning Britain show, in March, I think it was, over Meghan Markle. And, you know, it keeps sort of ebbing and flowing, but in the last week or so, two people who should know have said that it seems to be a live possibility again. I haven't been able to contact Piers to confirm or not deny this because he's blocked me on Twitter. I made the error of pointing out his hypocrisy over the COVID thing when he was emphasising the importance of lockdown. And then when his own son went on a Black Lives Matter protest, it was all okay again then. So, don't, whatever you do, pinpoint Piers' hypocrisy. But despite all of that, you know, I'm really torn on this issue. I can see the advantages and the disadvantages. I don't have anything personal against Piers, but we're not in touch anymore.
Yeah, I mean, he is a very clever broadcaster, and you know, an exceptional media operator. It's fair to say, though, isn't it, Tim, that he is Marmite. I mean, even some of the people who watch him a lot and pay a lot of attention to Piers Morgan find him quite annoying from time to time. The channel would be getting someone very controversial. Would the aim be to attract as much attention as possible, simply to boost audience?
I think so. I think GB News is on a little bit of an upward swing at the moment. It obviously had a slightly difficult launch. Let's just put it like that. But yeah. The Farage programme that started at 7 o'clock every night is beating Sky and BBC equivalents in that slot. I think the move of Simon McCoy to the breakfast show has definitely sort of reinforced that. There seems to be, you know, more of a professionalism to that particular slot. I think the Liam and Gloria, Liam Halligan, Gloria DiPiero afternoon shift, there's real chemistry between them. And then there's certain sort of, they're really doing YouTube quite well. So you're getting things like Neil Oliver, the Coast guy that many people are familiar with from the BBC. Those are real YouTube hits are taking off. They seem to have taken quite a bit of the advice that Reaction dispensed. Maggie Pagano and I did a little video a couple of weeks ago, said the kind of things that they should do, including have news bulletins.
What a crazy idea.
Exactly.
Putting news bulletins on a news channel. But it was a really, it was a really good list. So sorry, the others were...
No, I think those are the other one was sort of cutting some of the presenter slots, which they've done. We did say that they should keep Guto Harry, who famously took the knee on one programme and caused a semi-boycott by viewers. They didn't take that idea. I think it was too far gone that Guto was on the sort of exit slope by that stage. But generally, I think that some of the, what I understand is that certainly the video we produced was well circulated around the company and amongst senior staff. And I've had nothing but positive responses from people and saying that there's more changes underway. And so this, one of the things we suggested that it's quite a lot for any presenter to do 3 hours and that it should be shorter. And I understand that's going to begin to happen. It's already happened with Michelle Dubry, and I think it will happen with a few of the other presenters as well. But even with all of that, it was always going to be, you know, a new venture is always hard to take off. And I think the idea is that Piers Morgan coming in would just give you an immediate, you know, a new audience. Yes, he's a Marmite, as you say, Ian, but look at the ratings of Good Morning Britain since he left. They do slightly better, but he got to peaks, often getting quite close to the BBC breakfast show that Jim Beers never got since. Whether you like him or not, he gets ratings. You pay for it, the sort of astronomical fees that have sort of been rumoured that would needed to be paid in order to get him to sign on the dotted line, you know, are expensive. But, you know, they've got some big investors, GB News, and it might be worth getting him because it will probably solidify the whole of the channel.
Now, Carolyn Harris is a Labour MP with real clout. She keeps on changing government policy by generating good ideas and persuasively working on a cross-party basis. Tim spoke to Carolyn about the experience that shaped her approach to politics. You can watch the whole interview on our YouTube channel, but here's a taster.
So let's start with perhaps is the hardest thing for you to talk about, but is your successful campaign to pay for children's funerals. And you lost your own son in a road traffic accident. And tell us if you can, and I'm sorry to put you on the spot with this, but tell us what happened and why you fought a campaign, which was really your first big parliamentary victory.
Yeah, well, I lost Martin when he was 8. And at the time I was a barmaid and a dinner lady. And my husband worked on the railway. He was working on the tools. So we were just a normal youngish couple with two small kids. We could just about afford to scrape together the money to go and have a caravan holiday somewhere in West Wales. We lost Martin, and this bill turned up for a funeral, and it was so far out of our league in terms of the cost. And
give us a brief idea of how big it was at the time. How much it would be in money today?
Well, it probably equates to about £4,000 today. Yeah. Because that's roughly how much it costs for a funeral.
Yeah.
And just before we had the bill, in Wales we got this habit of when somebody's had a bereavement, the neighbours and friends turn up with something. They'll come with a bag of tea bags, a tin of biscuits, a jar of coffee, we just don't know what to do to make things easier, so we just turn up for things. And when you lose a child, that is amplified. And David's mates in the pub just didn't know what to do, and they'd had a whip round. So we had the bill. I never locked what was in this envelope, and I went to the drawer and I looked, and there was £1,000 in it. And I needed to find 1,750 plus. I'd always worn a gold St. Christopher crucifix around my neck. And when I had Martin buried, I'd insisted on Martin wearing that to be buried in. And David was really, because my husband was really concerned that I didn't have my cross anymore, and I always wore mine. So he wanted to replace that. So we actually needed 1,850. So we opened the envelope and there was £1,000 in it.
Wow.
So then David went to the bank, explained the situation, and borrowed the other 850, which we then paid back as a loan. And we paid the bill, and that was that. And it was something that always bothered me, that I'm not alone. There's roughly 5,000 children a year pass away. Some will be stillbirth, some will be from natural causes, some will be because of accidents and tragedy. So it was something that always bothered me. And when I became an MP, one of the reasons I became an MP, Tim, and probably the biggest, most important reason, was that as someone who's from a normal, ordinary working class family and normal working class area, I knew that the platform of being an MP, having those letters after your name, opened so many doors, not just for other people, but for me in terms of what I can do to help other people. And I suppose you could say I've exploited those letters, because everything I've done have been because I've got those letters after my name. Mm. And I thought, right, this is my opportunity. And I'll never forget the time I mentioned it, because I can see the minister, Marcus, now, he's a whip now. He just didn't know what was going to happen. It was in a German debate. I didn't have a speech because I didn't need to. It was my story. Yeah. And I started talking, and I never forget the look on that poor man's face. He just was not expecting me to say what I said. And everybody, it was silence in the chamber. He was choked. And then from then, the response from the public was overwhelming. I had emails, letters, phone calls from parents saying that they'd had threats of the stones being removed from their child's grave because they couldn't pay the bill, that they'd had to borrow money.
That was threats from undertakers or something, was it? Because the bill hadn't been paid? Or who was that?
Yeah, it was that kind of thing. You know, I don't think it was the undertakers. I think it was debt collectors. I think at some point the undertakers had passed it on to a debt collector. Yeah, I heard stories of how, I feel sorry for undertakers because they are essential. They cannot say no, and yet they can't always be guaranteed to get their money. And I do feel for them.
Yeah.
And undertakers, in some cases, were having to ask families to undergo a credit check in order to be able to conduct the funeral, or suggest an environment funeral, which was a pauper's funeral back in my day. Yeah. And I just thought, this is so wrong for any parent, because you can't imagine how it feels to lose your child, and you can't imagine how long that grief and that black place hangs over you. It hangs over you forever, but after 2 years, at least I started to come out and started to re-engage with society. But to not have been able to pay Martin's funeral, and to have not been able to give him that last thing that I could ever give him and say I'd done it with all I could, with all my heart, was, would have been awful. And so I started asking, and I asked, and I asked, and I asked. And I was a bloody nuisance. I know I was. But I had people I think I first met IDS, Ian Duncan Smith, on that one, who totally got what I was saying. People like Jacob Rees-Mogg, who, people in Swansea would run in the opposite direction rather than have a conversation with Jacob Rees-Mogg. You know, people who, they showed me at that point that in some issues, there is no politics.
This week, in the second episode of our new show, Press Review, Ian, Tim Montgomery and Tim Marshall, reaction columnist and best-selling author, chose the stories in the media that grabbed them. From the New York Democrat centrist ex-cop giving moderates new hope, to Sir Walter Scott's 250th anniversary, from Janice Turner on transgenderism and the law, to the military tension in the South China Sea. Have a listen. Here's the whole show.
Can we kick things off with your first choice, Tim Marshall, and we've got two Tims on the show today. So Tim Marshall, and if I call you Marshall or Monty at any point, I'm not being rude. It's simply to avoid confusion on the Tim front. But Tim Marshall, your first choice, the first story that you want to talk about.
Thank you, Ian. Yeah, it's an interesting one because it's the website is interesting. It's on Real Clear Defence. Now, I suspect Tim Montgomery, well, both of you probably know Real Clear Politics.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, it's a great place to aggregate loads and loads of stuff, and you can just scroll down it and all these headlines from papers all over the world. And I was doing that on Real Clear Defence and one took my fancy. It's actually just a Reuters story that has been picked up and published by a magazine, but it's out of New Delhi. And it caught my attention because it fits into a long-term narrative of countries in the South China Sea region increasingly taking a harder line when it comes to defense against China. India is a member of the Quad. India, Japan, Australia and the United States. And the Quad is an informal but becoming more formal alliance designed in naval terms to box in China. So this caught my attention. New Delhi, August 4th, Reuters. India is sending a naval task force to the South China Sea this month to expand security ties with friendly countries, signaling its intent to play a bigger role in regional efforts. The military has traditionally been wary of antagonizing China, but the mood is hardening. Four ships, a guided missile destroyer and a missile frigate, two-month period, Southeast Asia, South China Sea, and the Western Pacific. And what also caught my attention about this story is that you probably know the British aircraft carrier, HMS Elizabeth II, is currently in the region, and it recently sailed through the South China Sea. China says it did not enter its 12-mile navigation zone, which, if it's China, Chinese territory, law of the sea says you cannot go within 12 miles, nautical miles of it. The thing is, as you know, China's built all these artificial islands. You know, they've got a little rock sticking out of the sea and they've dumped enough concrete on it to build a runway. And they then say it's Chinese sovereign territory, which is a moot international legal point. From their interpretation, go inside it, hostile act. From everybody else's interpretation, what are you talking about? That's an international sea lane. So the Chinese say the British didn't. The British are keeping a bit shtum about it. And it all fits into this increased narrative, A, of the British focus on Asia Pacific, ditto America, ditto Australia, obviously. And now India is also signalling its intentions.
What do you think, Tim, that the Chinese intentions are here? Are they deliberately upping the ante on this stuff because
yes.
The leader's a Chinese nationalist? And what are they?
Yes,
what's the end point?
They're playing the long game, and I think they will for some considerable time. You know, there are people that think they're going to try and invade Taiwan within 5 years, and I don't agree with that. But we're all guessing. When China looks out at the world, it sees in front of it this barrier called the first island chain, consisting of places like Taiwan and the Philippines and Japan and some of the South Korean islands. And in times of extremists, it would prevent them from getting out into the Pacific. So their role and their aim, and it's quite understandable, I'd do it if I was king of China, is to break that chain. You can do it one and both of two ways. One, you could invade Taiwan. Two, you can flip places like the Philippines into your sphere of influence, and they're really trying hard to flip the Philippines. It's the one potential one that might. I don't think it will. The British carrier, by the way, is going to go down there to the Philippines in a couple of weeks' time. The other way is to force everybody back, and they're doing that in two ways. One, their shorter-ship missile system is brilliant and getting better, and they're getting longer and longer range. And the longer their really top-notch missiles can go, the further back the US fleets need to keep. That's the first way they're doing it militarily. The second way is these islands. If you build enough of them and put runways and anti-aircraft batteries and missiles on them and say they're your sovereign territory, and then every time someone comes near to it, you say, that's sovereign territory, or you take a case to international law, There will come a time in the middle of the century when they're powerful enough, when they've got enough carrier groups, enough missiles, when they'll say, we've been telling you for decades about this, and now we're going to do something about it. So that's what I mean about the long-term thinking.
Yeah, I mean, they're becoming more aggressive assertive.
Assertive, yeah.
Assertive is the phrase. And it runs through, there's just so many examples of it. One that caught my eye, one of my story choices for this week was from the Wall Street Journal, which is, the headline was Communism in the Classroom. China is now purging Hong Kong teachers. And it's on the back of the Education Bureau, effectively the party, saying that it won't now recognize the Hong Kong Professional Teachers Union. Now it's got tens of thousands of members, I think. And it's accused of fomenting anti-Communist Party propaganda. And there's been a litany of stories like this since the, since the recent kind of meltdown. A primary school teacher who's then punished in June, I think, for buying copies of the now defunct Apple Daily, newspaper that's closed. Yeah. They seem determined to dominate. They don't seem, Tim Montgomery, they don't seem particularly worried about the impact of their brand. And it might sound quixotic to present it in those terms, but the Chinese brand is not particularly appealing in the West at the moment. Of course, they're big investors, but they seem determined to just sort of charge ahead with this policy of being more assertive. And you've made the point to me recently, Tim Montgomery, that China, the story runs through so many stories. It's just part. It's part of almost everything we're discussing: climate, defense, economics, rebalancing the world, diplomacy.
Yeah, seems funny you calling me Tim Montgomery. I think you just called me Monty or something for the purposes Monty. Of the French in between Tim's today. But I did a sort of a silly poll on Twitter last week, just asking people, what they thought was the biggest problem. Well, what history we remember our time for? Was it climate change, the challenge of climate change? Was it the rise of China? Was it technological change, or was it COVID? And, it's a completely unscientific poll, but about 13,000 people took part. And it was pretty evenly divided. People actually chose COVID, which I think for me was the wrong answer. I don't think this time will be remembered for COVID. And for me, it was interesting. China was ahead of climate change. No one at the BBC seemed to ever thought that that might be the case in public opinion. But the thing I sort of took from it really was that China really was involved in all of the other three options. We're not going to solve climate change without addressing the fact that China are building all these coal-fired power stations. Technological change is completely wrapped up with the way that Chinese manufacturing industry has reduced the cost of so much. TikTok, of course, is Chinese owned. COVID, of course, came from China, whether from a wet market or from the Wuhan lab, we don't know. But China just isn't getting the coverage, I think, in our media that it deserves. That's partly, of course, because broadcasters like the BBC struggle to get into China. So there's a lack of the basic pictures, the films that make news interesting to people. But actually, if our news really was covering the most important stuff in the world, China would be leading most bulletins regularly. Yeah. But there just isn't, they don't speak the same language as us. So we like to talk to about American politicians. We don't have the access to cover China properly.
Yeah.
And
it's the cultural thing, Tim. I agree. I know. I see where you're going with that. And I agree. We know Joe Biden. If you're interested in politics, Anthony Blinken, Secretary of State. There's probably a handful. After Xi, which many people will not have heard of in Chinese politics, we know nothing. We don't know the name of the foreign minister, etc. Yeah. Same with the big cultural stars. And I think it's just because we find it difficult. So, and it's because of that, I don't think we really get just how influential China is in the world.
What would you do about it? Sorry, Ian, what would you do about it, Tim? Is there anything that can be?
Try harder. And hope the audience went with you. I mean, your point about pictures is absolutely correct. And there's not a great deal you can do about that other than some really intrepid and dangerous journalism, but a bit of social media. But you could just say, I'm a bit behind the times here, but Beyonce has sold X. This person has sold Y. But there's a difference there because Beyonce has sold X globally, and this person has sold Y probably pretty much in China. You know, Chinese soft power isn't really breaking out. And I don't think it's going to. But when I was at Sky News, the editor, John Riley, was a very, very clever guy and very quite far-sighted. And more than a decade ago, he brought everyone together and said, we have got to hammer this story. This is absolutely the dominant story in the world, China, China, China. And he laid out a big presentation for us. But, you know, the admiral can only steer the ship so much. You know, everybody else has to be going along and people just get... So I think Sky have done a good job, but nobody's really covered China. I learned more from a novel I read recently, I think, about China, called China by Rutherford, than I do perhaps from the news.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that was noteworthy about that little leader opinion piece by the editorial board in the Wall Street Journal about that that story of communism in the classroom in Hong Kong, was that they explicitly said a lot of this stuff is not being covered, and that they see part of their job on the editorial.
Thanks. I just thought of another. Sorry to interrupt. I just thought of another example as well. When 5G came up and the whole of Huawei, whether it's going to be in our system, you know, most people are starting from a standing start because we haven't reported properly on the economic side of China, how every single big Chinese company is in the grip of the Communist Party, that you cannot succeed in that country without being preferably a member, and most of the big entrepreneurs are. Whereas if we'd understood the absolute symbiotic relationship between the multinationals or the big companies and the party, we would have a much better concept of why this is an issue at all.
Yeah, we were very naive in the West and sort of 10 years or so ago about it. But the Wall Street Journal did just make the point that they're going to keep on, that it's just that, you know, water dripping on stone effect, that they'll just keep on pointing out this stuff. And that's on the opinion pages of the journal. Now, I'm going to move things on from China and go to your first pick of the week, Monty, Tim Montgomery.
Do you want New York or do you want conservative land first?
I would go with New York. I just think you've alighted on something so interesting.
Okay, well, I'm a supporter of the other Tim's Media 360 label, partly because the first pick I've chosen isn't a press article or anything, but a podcast. And I stopped listening to... I used to listen pretty religiously to the New Yorker podcast interviews. They were really good. And then, like a lot of, you know, media during the Trump era, it was unlistenable to, you know, they just hated Trump. Everything was about Trump hatred. You had similar thing on the right. You know, there were Trump supporting podcasts I just couldn't listen to at all. There was just no balance or, sophistication or subtlety in any of it. But I'm back onto the New Yorker podcast now, and they are really thoughtful interviews. Now Trump derangement syndrome seems to be ebbing. And in a way, the interview that I picked with Eric Adams is the new Democrat candidate for the city of New York. Sort of is part of this process of politics hopefully returning to some sort of closer to normality. He's a really hopeful addition to the political landscape. He's a former New York cop who joined the police partly because of his own experience at being brutalized by New York policing in his early years. He's a black guy, black New Yorker. And he talks really about the journey that he's been on. He lost friends. He suffered violence from racist policing when he was growing up. But at the same time, he saw when the police retreated from his communities, black community, majority communities in New York, he saw the effect of drug gangs taking over. In this interview, he talks about the fact that New York's high taxes are basically pushing away the wealthier Americans, the job creators from the city he loves. And he said that's going to have an impact on all the public services that New Yorkers depend upon. There's a subtlety to this guy. There's an interest in picking the best of the Republican side and the best of the Democrat side, being willing to criticize both. I just haven't heard, you know, many people in US politics talking like this for a long time. And Ian, we spoke a little while ago. I sort of was one of the first big cracks in wokedom if you like, because the Liberal Democratic establishment did not want this guy to be their candidate and one of their supposed strongholds on earth. And he's taking, you know, wants to take an approach to crime that's closer to Giuliani than, you know, the average Liberal Democrat. And yet he's broken through because woke policing, even in one of the most liberal cities on earth, if you start becoming like Gotham City, people rebel. I think he's a sign that in a world where we're getting more extreme Democrats, more extreme Republicans, and in other countries too, if you get the right messenger, you can still win through with moderation. He hasn't taken office, of course, yet. He may be a disaster. But I found the interview inspiring, and I find his candidacy inspiring.
I find that story, his appearance, really a moment of optimism and hope, because we've been hearing a lot recently about the poor condition of democracy. And you know, I interviewed Jan Werner Müller last week about his new book, Democracy Rules, and he's not particularly hopeful or optimistic. But we talked about the regenerative power of democracy. And after this long phase where everyone's fixating on populism, and large parts of the left have gone as mad as the Trumpian right, and concluded with the wrong lesson, I think, which is that to beat populism on the nativist right, what you need is far left populism. And it's kind of self-defeating and depressing. What's interesting about him is the way in which he's interested in nuance, prepared to admit weakness, prepared to learn. And it's not quite New Labour or New Democrats, but there's a flavour of it, just a sense of sensible centrists. And he's one of the first manifestations of it, reappearing and trying to carve out a new kind of politics. So it's not Bill Clinton yet or Tony Blair. And there will be some people listening to that saying, God forbid, others who will say, bring it on. But something hopeful beyond Trump world is happening. I mean, it's the antidote to AOC.
Yeah.
And the politics, which was the reverse of the mirror image rather of Trumpism. Tim, Marshall, that is. So I'll just call you Marshall, you know, to distinguish you from Monty. Have you tracked Adam's appearance?
Very vaguely, but of course Montgomery was a field marshal, I think. So we are, you know, there's a synergy here. It was vaguely on my radar, and thank you to Montgomery that I now know a lot more about him and can, you know, the drop of a hat, we'll talk about him. Because I don't know much about him, I can't speak to that. But the stuff about his inherent sensibleness did strike a chord, because actually that's where most people are. You know, I shout and rage, as I'm sure many of us do, and shout at the television and the radio when people say in a Twitter survey or a Twitter says or social media, and you think, and so what? You know, 13% of people are on Twitter apparently in the UK, and yet, you know, a handful of people say X and people think, and it becomes a story, but it actually isn't. Whereas most people seem to be pretty much where this Democrat ex cop is, saying sensible things in a moderate tone, and there is a market for it. So if sections of the media could just hold their nerve a bit and stop chasing cheap headlines, we'd actually have a better debate, and this podcast seems to be part of it.
I do think it's the next, and goodness, politics in the last 10 years or since the crash has proved people, proved all of us wrong on so many occasions about, you know, where it's going next.
No.
But it feels to me as though the next turn, the next part of the story is a switch back to something a bit less angry. You know, if you take the Tory party in the UK, there isn't another Boris. And the Tory party having used Boris for its own ends, and Boris having used the Tory party for its own ends, is not, I don't think, in its next phase post-Boris, whether that's in 10 months' time or in 4 years' time, isn't, and there isn't someone available. Isn't
these pendulums swing very slowly. You know,
they and it's more likely to be someone that can then be presented to the outside world, to Britain's allies who are worried about Britain and Britain's sort of Britain's positioning and demeanour. It's more likely to be someone, a man or a woman who people say, right, it's back to something a bit more.
Well, that's where Byron.
I don't mean that as an insult. Just someone who's more normal. Someone
that's Joe Biden, though. I mean, he is, you know, a centrist dad. Now he's having to pay attention to his left flank and not criticize the squad, AOC, too much. But that's part of that pendulum.
I think he's part of the old politics, and he was on a rescue mission. It's like a disaster movie for the Democrats and for the anti-Trump forces, and they have to he has to come out and do what, sort of one last movie where he, you know, saves the day. I personally, I'll be surprised if he runs again. American
Agreed.
Tell me he definitely, you know, definitely will. But it feels as though it awaits a new generation of sensibles on the centre left and centre right to reappear. Shall we move on to the next subject? Whose turn is it next? Actually, having talked about how moving back to a more reasonable way of talking about politics, I think Tim Marshall, you wanted to talk about transgenderism, which is
I'm glad you. I don't normally talk about transgenderism, but I'm glad you moved straight onto it, because I actually think there is a link to the previous conversation, because I detect in that debate some people getting their bottle back and feeling able to discuss it. Because what happened over the past couple of years is that many people just retreated in fear that if they said anything moderate, even sympathetic, but from a certain position, they were screened down and people stopped saying anything. Now, Janice Turner in the Times newspaper has been probably leading the charge on this in not writing anything in an aggressive manner, but asking some genuine questions about the whole transgender debate. And so many people are approaching it now saying, you know, I would be quite happy to say she, he, or whatever somebody wants. I'm quite happy to, you know, full rights, this, that, and the other. But on the science, which is where, for me, it comes down to. So I think just as there are these increasingly moderate voices, hopefully brave enough to come to politics, I think it's the same with this. So page 52 in today in Thursday's Times, in the law section, and which I don't normally read, but it just caught my attention, and it's outside of my area, you know, it's not foreign policy, but why it caught my attention is because it's approaching it from the legal standpoint and the Olympics. Transgender athletes test sporting principles. And they've gone to some eminent law firms and they've asked them, what do you think about this? And they think that there are almost certainly, inevitable was one word used, that down the line, let's say, they don't say this, but let's say it's boxing, someone gets seriously injured, rugby would be another one, and they're going to bring a law case. They're going to say this transgender woman with their punching power, et cetera, was allowed into the ring with and damaged me in the way that someone who was a woman from birth could not have done. And that would go to court, and that would be a massive case. And then there's the other legal cases they think will come as well, which are simply on the basis of fairness. I mean, one would be a sort of damage case for damages and medical costs, etc. But the other one is about simply, you know, your policies denied my opportunity. So that's two different ways. And it's just, I just thought it was a useful introduction for me into a new aspect of this very delicate debate.
Monty, do you want to respond on that?
No, I'm just sort of tying up a little bit of our last two discussions, really, because we had this discussion about, you know, you were talking about, you know, China in the court of public opinion, what global public opinion, Ian. And I think they don't really care that much about that. I think they're much more interested in winning over international institutions, you know, their investment in organizations like the World Health Organization, et cetera. They want to have enough allies on the United Nations Human Rights Council and all these international bodies, whereby the architecture that supposedly governs the globe, that they have enough veto power so that what they want to get on with, they can get on with. Now, they're not completely indifferent to public opinion in individual countries, but they, you know, we're obsessed in democracies at public opinion.
True.
But actually, much of the world, really, public opinion doesn't matter at all. There's a whole plethora of very powerful institutions run by what would be called men in grey suits, or increasingly women in the world today. But basically, it's all done behind closed doors. It's one of the reasons why I wanted to leave the European Union, because I think democracy matters in a way whereby powerful courts, central banks, bureaucracies, commissions have disproportionate power in the EU. And I think what the other Tim, my fellow military marshal, Montgomery, whatever, is getting at, is that's, I think, where a lot of transgender issues are going to be sorted as well. However much we may worry about what voters think, it's probably going to be how judges resolve a lot of these issues. I suspect we are about to potentially see a landmark ruling in the United States Supreme Court on whether Roe versus Wade continues in the same way. And I expect it will probably be transgender rights rather than in a dysfunctional Congress where this will be. So even in democracies, it's in the courtrooms where things are increasingly going to be decided. So, And I think, you know, generally for those of us who are interested in politics, I wonder whether we have enough scrutiny of the kind of people being appointed to top judicial positions in our country. And I don't really want to politicize the judiciary, but in a way it already is politicized. They're taking incredibly political decisions. So China's a big issue, and then the way we've been taken over by courts is another huge issue, and I think China gets it more than we do.
Briefly, just picking up on that, recently it appears that the Chinese Foreign Ministry has instructed its diplomats around the world to quit with the wolf diplomacy. They have this name for it, that they went out there snarling, and they realised, and it was, I think it was after the first meeting with the Biden administration, when they said, what, you want to talk to us as an equal? You're not. They pretty much said that. And the backlash... And everyone, you know, because a lot of people have turned against China, they're dialing it down. But on Tim's other point about approaching the institutions and capturing them, yeah, because they can still do that quietly while dialing down all the language. And there's two great sayings. I've forgotten the Chinese version of it, but it was speak softly and carry a big stick. They had something like that under Dao Xiaoping, which they were doing for a long time. And under Xi, they haven't been speaking so softly. I think they may go back a bit. And the other one, Dao Xiaoping said, was go forward by feeling the steps in the water. And I think they were feeling the steps in the water when they were so belligerent with the Americans. And then, maybe that isn't the route. So we might see a slightly quieter, but the aim is the same.
So next choice, I think, Tim, is Tim Montgomery, is yours. And you wanted to talk about a publication which I think I dimly heard of, but you picked up on the newsstand.
Yeah, well...
European Conservative.
Flash that up. I think I was in Waterloo Station the other night coming home, and... W.H. Smith seems to be at airports and railway stations. You need a mortgage to buy a biro. Everything there from Haribo to Penn seems to be about three times as much as on the high street. But at least this was £9.90, which is one of the most expensive magazines I bought recently. But I think of myself as a pretty, enthusiastic conservative. But I hadn't heard about this magazine. Read it on the train coming home. And it's sort of more urbanistic than, you know, many journals. I think it's definitely more I think Tucker Carlson would enjoy it more than David Frum. But there is sort of it's got some really interesting features in it. There's three obituaries at the end to Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, to the Duke of Edinburgh, and to Peregrine Walsthorn, the former editor of the Sunday Telegraph, were the first things that I read. Really well written. And I don't know whether you remember, we're all of similar ages, but the editorial, it sort of took me back to the editorials that Peregrine Walsthorn used to write in the Sunday Telegraph during the 80s and 90s. It was an extraordinary time in British politics when Thatcherism was such a dominant debate. And the Sunday Telegraph every week was this extraordinary experience of the clashing voices of conservatism between authority and liberty. And Peregrine Walsthorn was kind of the judge with his signed editorials that he wrote. I think they were 1,500, 2,000 words each time. He must have spent a day or two writing them. They were beautifully written and crafted. It took me back to that. there's just various features you just wouldn't get anywhere else. It talked about the battle for a more pro-life culture in Europe. It's clearly a very anti-abortion magazine, but it was just refreshing and interesting to read a piece that was actually different from what you would get The Guardian, The Times or The Telegraph at the moment, where these views are all covered in the sort of slightly same liberal worldview. But so it's not going to be for everyone. It is probably more Orbanistic than many other journals, but it was just so different from what I'm reading in the British press.
You just reminded me, Tim, on Peregrine Worsthorne. I had several encounters with him down the years. Some fun, in fact, quite a loss actually, and it was fun sometimes. But the just reminded of those days in the Sunday Telegraph, where before my time, and he was of course in charge of the leaders. But he didn't really, so that meant that he locked himself in his office and was not to be disturbed, I think, for large parts of Friday and Saturday while he wrote this great missive. And then the newspaper was sort of produced around him. They would go out for lunch on the Saturday. They all decamped to Elvino's across the road. This is, of course, before the Telegraph moved to moved to Canary Wharf, where they would then have lunch and a gallon of Red Infuriator, whatever, then go back and then produce.
Those were the days.
A colleague and a subscriber to, a friend and subscriber to Reaction, who worked in a senior capacity under Perry on the Sunday Telegraph, always delights in telling this story about how when they got some particular story on which Perry first heard about, on a sort of Saturday morning conference, he said, it really is most remarkable. How do you find all this out? Where on earth do you get all these new stories from? So yes, you're right. A completely different era. Though just to flag up that price point, that's interesting, isn't it? £9. Did you say £9 for print?
£9.99,
isn't it?
£9.99.
There's clearly a demand for print. Print is not dead, but the economics of it have changed so much that you do have to.
There's clearly a demand for print, but is there clearly a demand for this print? I mean, I'm not knocking it. Well, no, actually, I am.
Go on, knock it.
Well, okay, a tenner. And the audience has got to be Tim and someone Tim knows. It's certainly too highbrow for me. It's politics and not entirely to my taste, but that's. I don't care one way or the other about that particularly. I'm just looking through it and I'm quite impressed because it genuinely is European. Editor-in-chief Alvino Mario Fantini, managing editor Ellen Krieger Fantini, surely not a married couple, in charge. I've never heard of such a thing. Hang on a minute. De Pippo, Matt Edwards, Morello, Charles, Colomb, Battisti, Respinti, Van Maren. I mean, this is good stuff. This is a genuine European advisory council. The late Roger Scruton, even now, dispensing his wisdom.
Looking down on us. Great man.
And the only name I recognise on there is Anne Elizabeth Moutet. Right.
Robin Harris is, I think, on the board.
Yes, Robin Harris as well.
Anne Elizabeth, is a Reaction subscriber and reader. Yep.
And Razyad Legutko, I think I've heard of. But the point I'm making is that how can it survive? Now, it reminded me slightly of Standpoint magazine, which is extremely well written, I think, but it doesn't sell hundreds of thousands or even tens of thousands. At £10 a pop, at four times a year, how will it? Is there a demand for it?
And also, if you're going to do it, Tim, then the print. So, Tim, I'm directing this to Tim Marshall. The print quality has to be very high. So it has to be printing is a lot cheaper than it.
Yeah, is it glossy?
Because there's a lot of spare capacity. Monty? But it has to be really, really high res and look absolutely beautiful, which is then expensive. And distribution has a lot of fixed costs in print. You've also then just teed up absolutely perfectly a plug for Reaction, which isn't $9.99.
All run by a married couple.
Exactly.
Excuse me.
Well, sort of, actually, it is. Managing editor of Reaction, Fiona Martin. But the point I was making is that Reaction, £6 a month or £60 for the year is obviously then fantastic value, and the price is going up soon. So if you do want to become a subscriber to Reaction, get all of the brilliant writing by Tim Marshall, me, the team, our columnists, people like David Waywall and Maggie Pagano, my colleague, and all the brilliant work by the team, you just go to the website. It's underneath this, this on our YouTube channel. And you try a free 30-day trial, and Reaction helps explain the news, and it's hopefully fun to read. But back to our paper review, Media 360 review. I think we have one story left. I think it's from me, and it's a slight change of pace. It fits into the "and finally" category. And I just wanted to highlight something made by BBC Radio 3 and a programme made by the broadcaster Alan Little, you know, of the Beeb for forever. And it's called Great Scots. It was a Sunday feature on Radio 3 a couple of weeks ago, Radio 3 profile of Sir Walter Scott. And it's 250 years this month, in 10 days' time, actually, 15th of August. It's the 250th anniversary of Walter Scott's birth. Now, the reason I wanted to flag it is a really good piece of radio documentary making. I learned a lot. It resolved me to read more Scott, as you know, Neil Ferguson, who spent lockdown reading Neil Scott, has said, reading Walter Scott, has said, look, invest the time, and I'm going to remind you that Walter Scott's work is tough. It's a, you know, really hard read. And I had, you know, one criticism, which is just a classic sort of BBC thing. I learned a lot until you got into the sort of discussion of the politics, and it was framed through Scott, of course, is the man who invents the kind of modern conception of Scotland and the romantic idea of the sort of romantic myth of Scotland, and famously, you know, reinvents the tartan for the visit of the king to Edinburgh. And he's then rejected as being a sort of tartan and heather version of Scotland, which is unfair, and rejected by literary critics in the 60s, 70s and 80s for being unfashionable. And Alan Little is exploring whether, you know, that's fair or not. So I wanted to flag that up as an example of something made by the Beeb that, you know, fulfilled the license fee remit of teaching me something and being hugely enjoyable. So I would recommend it. I mean, we can conclude there unless either of you have something startling to say about Sir Walter Scott.
What's Radio 3, Ian?
Well, listen, it's this...
it's a good mind, though, because actually there's some really good programmes on Radio 3, and I've sort of got into the habit of sort of... I go between the Radio 4 and the World Service and don't really go anywhere else. And that sounds fascinating, and I probably should spend more time looking at
it.
I don't like the music output of Radio 3, but actually they do a lot more than the music, don't they?
Well, I do like the music output, and particularly, I mean, some traditionalist Radio 3 fans will, I mean, that's the thing, you'll always get Radio 3 fans complaining about how it's changed and it's not what it used to be. But the night track stuff that they do is a very meditative, interesting way to spend the day if you're, to finish the day if you're reading or something. And it's, you know, kind of supposed to be soothing and relaxing, but also within it are really interesting music choices. And I've discovered lots of music through that. The lunchtime concerts are, you know, been, you know, outstanding throughout the pandemic. They've got a really big, big archive, and I think they've got the balance right again. I think, and please get in touch if you're a Radio 3 listener and you disagree violently. But it's, I think they've got that blend between speech and discussion and, you know, the long form playing of music. I think they're on a bit of a roll again. And also, I mean, the reason I really got back into it in a big way was during the Brexit wars, was that I just couldn't, much as I, you know, been raised listening to the Today programme in the morning, I just couldn't stand it anymore because of the sort of people shouting endlessly about Brexit and going round and round in circles. So I switched to Petroc Trelawney, his breakfast show, and suddenly the world looked about 200 times better just by listening to classical music in the morning rather than listening to people argue about Brexit. So Radio 3 gets my stamp of approval at the moment.
The Reaction team there, with their weekly pick of global stories and great journalism. I'm Francesca Peacock. You've been listening to the Reaction podcast. Until next week, thank you for listening.